Folks, have you checked out the Irish History Podcast shop recently? Right now, I have a sale of 30% off everything when you use the code SALE30. So go to irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop and get 30% off everything when you use the discount code SALE30.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hi folks, and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. This show is a Christmas special of sorts for the podcast. I'm sitting here in Hughes' pub in the heart of Dublin. I have a very special guest here with me. We've got a couple of pints in front of us, and we're going to chat about one of the most incredible historical locations around Dublin. It's a castle that was for centuries, I suppose you could say forgotten, but excavations there over the last 15 to 20 years revealed a brutal siege, a massacre, and an incredible insight into an Ireland that's scarcely imaginable today. Now, before we get into all that, I just want to give the pub a mention here. So I'm sitting in Hughes' pub, located right beside a setting actually that was mentioned in two recent episodes. So that's the Four Courts, and that's where the Four Courts explosion took place, just 50 metres from here. And then Bob Doyle, who was mentioned in Partisans Part 3, was born only 200 metres from here. As this is the last show of 2019, I just want to keep the housekeeping down to an absolute minimum, so I'm just going to ask you for two quick favours. If you haven't subscribed to the Irish History Podcast, please do. It does make a great difference. And secondly, if you could share this episode with a pal you might think would enjoy it and recommend they subscribe to, that would be great. Also, if you want to share and tag me on Twitter, my Twitter handle is Irish History. I'll retweet it. All these small acts really help out with the show. Anyway, that's all the housekeeping done for the year. Now I want to introduce my guest, and that's Mark Clinton, someone I've known for over 15 years. So Mark, do you want to introduce yourself?
My name is, as you rightly said, Mark Clinton, Dr. Mark Clinton. As Ned Kelly, formerly of the National Museum, once said to me, now that you have the new fancy title, the only time you're ever going to use it is to annoy people. So let me start off by annoying your listeners.
Well, I first met Mark on working on the first archaeological excavation that I ever worked on, and that was Carrick Mines Castle. And maybe to set the scene so of Carrick Mines Castle, which we're going to talk about today, some listeners will be familiar from early episodes of the podcast about tensions that would have arose in Ireland after the Norman invasion between the Norman colony, maybe centred in and around Dublin, and then Gaelic Irish families in the Wicklow Mountains. And to explain to people, Carrick Mines Castle was built essentially on what was a frontier between these two areas.
Yeah, I think if you were sort of designing where to place the capital, our principal city of any state, Dublin was in the wrong place. Because and especially vis-a-vis the Pale, the English colony, Drogheda might have been a bit better, because Dublin, if you think about it, and as often it surprises you, you're walking down the street in Dublin and you catch sight of, there's the Wicklow Dublin Mountains. They're actually very close. And if you take it that they were densely forested and there were no roads in there or anything, you had this kind of really wild terrain on your doorstep. So Dublin was in a very vulnerable place. So it was fine when it was on the ascendant. But as after the initial incursions, and I mean, things get off to a flying start, because one must never forget that, I mean, the Strongbow and his allies are relatives, because a lot of them are. It's one of the bizarre things, I think I address it in the opening section in the the Carrick Mines book.
Sorry, just according to there, Mark, just to let people know, you've written a book on all this, so if you just want to tell people...
Yes, it's called Carrick Mines, Castle, Rise and Fall. And it basically is... It's the story of the site itself, the monument itself, but it also contextualises everything that's going on. It's a contemporary history of the period
I would say to people, really worth checking out. But maybe if you go back then and you're setting the scene great there with after the Norman invasion, you have Strongbow who is
and initially you have Strongbow and a lot of the others, like the antecedents of the Barry family, and they bring in a lot of Welsh people, settlers as well, like the Sinnets, lots of names that are still very familiar to people today, Fitzgeralds and all these. They are here at the request of what would be termed the legitimate king of Leinster, Dermot MacMurrough. And as such, things go very well. We go on a century or so, and things start going sour. Wicklow is now becoming hostile to Dublin, and now they realise they've got this fairly serious enemy, the O'Byrnes, the O'Tooles, on their doorstep. So Carrick Mines, this quiet little valley close to the Dublin mountains, finds itself, as you said, on a front line. So a site that had started off as a little farmstead, really, now starts becoming a fortified site, because the quiet life is over, and now they're absolutely vulnerable to constant raiding, you know, for cattle, for movable goods, etc. So Carrick Mines suddenly finds itself on the front line.
So as you've said there, it becomes a fortified site. And I guess we're talking now more, say, around the year 1300. Site, I suppose...
13th, 14th centuries now. It's getting hostile.
And I guess... If we've talked there about the establishment of the site because of this need for a fortified line, I suppose, for want of a better term, against the Gaelic Irish in the Wicklow Mountains that are gaining in strength, I think maybe we might move on to the most interesting chapter in the story, or move towards it, which is we're going to race here through now 300 years of history over the course of like a minute. But by the 17th century, that site has become a hell of a lot more than maybe the medieval fortified farmstead, or it's become a very serious military fortification. And maybe if you just want to explain a bit about the context of the progression of the site, I suppose, and also Irish politics is becoming a lot more violent as these centuries go on.
It was gradually getting there. I mean, before we get on to the very interesting 17th century, one of the most colourful people that ended up as the owner of the site was a man called Gianico D'Artasso. And there was a great quote from
I'm just going to cut in there.
Yeah.
Who is this person? That's not a name that you expect to pop up in Irish history.
Exactly. He was from Navarre.
Okay.
He had arrived with Richard II, who decided to turn up as sort of the first English monarch since Henry II to turn up. This would be in the late 1300s. And he granted Carrick Mines to this fellow who was kind of an adventurer who he'd been involved in sieges in Tunisia, wars against the Scots. He was fighting alongside the Teutonic Knights in Prussia, and he suddenly finds himself the owner of Carrick Mines. And Edmund Curtis, the great historian, described Gianico D'Artasso as a gallant personage who rides across the stage in all the valour, gaiety and colour of late medieval Europe. And he has quite an adventurous life. He writes to a former patron, an English bishop, to say, I've been granted this great chunk of land, because Carrick Mines wasn't his only grant. He got lots of other castles and things. He said, if only this was in central London, it would be worth a fortune. This man obviously was thinking ahead. Thinking he could have been the Duke of Westminster of his day. But no, he's on the border with the wild O'Byrnes and O'Tooles, who are determined to drive him out. As you say, it's the conflict is getting hotter as it goes along. the Earl of Southampton turns up in 1599, and he would be one of his claims to fame was that he was a patron of William Shakespeare. And indeed, the two of Shakespeare's works, there's a Venus and Adonis written in 1593 and the Rape of Lucretia in 1594. These are both dedicated to Henry, Earl of Southampton. And there has been, now I'm not a sort of a literary scholar or a Shakespearean scholar, but it has been suggested that they were very good friends, or the dedication is from Shakespeare to Henry is, "The love I dedicate to your lordship is without end." So the Earl turns up. He's there with a troop of horse at Carrick Mines again because trouble is a brewing in the mountains.
And maybe just to set a scene, maybe some of the politics that we're familiar with in terms of people talk about English invasions. Like, as you say at the very start, in terms of the Norman invasion, that's a very, very different kettle of fish. But by the year 1600, you have a much more centralised government in London that's starting to look at Ireland in terms of maybe colonialism in ways that are more reflective of how we would understand Irish history or how Irish history is understood today. And I think just the reason I'm bringing this up is that the level of conflict is intensifying, certainly in Ireland. I guess I'm thinking in the context of the plantations that had already gotten underway in Leash and Offaly, and I guess politics warfare is becoming much more politics, I suppose, is becoming much more violent. And I guess I suppose this is more of a question. I'm actually saying it as if I'm an expert on this, but I'm actually asking you here.
Oh, really? I was just sitting back enjoying this. All right, okay.
I'm asking you, but I suppose it is just to give people a sense, though, that this landscape and the people living in places like Carrick Mines are living through a pretty extreme time in Irish history.
I just mentioned when the Earl of Southampton was there, and that would have been in the context of the Nine Years' War. But when that comes to an end with the defeat of O'Neill and O'Donnell and all the rest of it, in the very early 1600s, bizarrely at that point, a relative peace descends on the land, because I think the Ulster has now been fairly well come out badly out of this. Peace descends on the land for the early part of the 1600s. You see, Ireland is complicated because you've three players as we're getting into the 1600s now. We've got three camps. We've got the New English, we've got the Old English, and we've got the Gaelic Irish.
And just to explain
this
to people,
really complicates things.
When we talk about New English, we are talking about settlers coming in from England, or most of them are actually coming from England, but that these people are relatively new to Ireland, and they do have a very different outlook on Ireland as a country.
And what really, really creates the whole new dimension is that nearly all of these new arrivals, once we're entering the 1600s, are Protestant. And Gaelic Ireland remains Catholic. English, Old English Ireland, mostly remains Catholic.
These three camps that we're talking about, the Old English, the Gaelic Irish,
yes,
and now this new wave of settlers from England.
Yes.
The tensions between these three groups of people pretty much explodes in the 17th century, that has huge implications for life in Carrick Mines. Now, not just in Carrick Mines, pretty much every single town and village in Ireland is on some level at some point affected by this. But these tensions, they're not the only reason, but contribute to a series of wars in Ireland that, you know, it has been argued one of the most serious events in Irish history in terms of changing the nature of life on the island.
Well, it did, because England couldn't quite accept the fact that you could be a Catholic and a loyal subject. Whereas the old English in Ireland maintained, yes, you could. I'm a Catholic by religion, but I am totally loyal to the English throne. And in many ways, they had to be. Like they, it was just the way they had been brought up forever, and they're intermarrying, as I said, one other. They feel like they're a, you know, it's in a way, it's quite, when you look at Northern Ireland today, it's quite a parallel in so much as the unionists of Northern Ireland today, they're clearly born, raised, live in Ireland. They can't all leave Ireland in the morning and go back to England. So, but they feel British. So they're in that kind of conundrum. It's the same with the old English. Like, we're loyal to the English monarch, but we happen to be Catholics. London had a problem with this. And but you can understand why London had a problem, because nearly everybody who threatened them, the Spanish or the French, they're all Catholic nations.
And they're obviously worried that somehow Catholics in Ireland, even if they profess complete loyalty, are at some point going to flip on this issue of religion and potentially support a Spanish invasion, which is already like you've had the Spanish Armada by this point.
Yeah, and we've had Kinsale and all the rest. Exactly.
Even in Ireland, you've had a potential invasion.
So
we've got this. I guess I'm trying to build us up to the year 1642
here,
because folks, 1642 has a fascinating story.
What happens is there's various political attempts to try and resolve all of this, but this is where events in England start overtaking events in Ireland. We're sliding now towards civil war in England, Parliament versus King, and the Gaelic Irish in late 1641 go into rebellion. Now, normally what would happen is that Westminster would dispatch an army to Ireland and to deal with this insurgency in Ulster. But Westminster can't do anything, because you've got the King and Parliament, and both of them are looking at one another, sort of saying, well, wait a minute. They're also worried about, how is Ireland going to play out when this civil war, they now know they're heading, they're sliding towards civil war in England. How is Ireland going to play in all of this? Whose side are they going to be on? The old English, the old Irish, you know, how is Scotland going to come? Everything is in the turmoil. A basic stupor. So that when this rebellion breaks out, no army arrives from England, because Parliament won't let the King send one in case this would be turning into something that might outmaneuver them. And Parliament won't. So nothing happens. So Ulster, the rebellion happens, and then it starts spilling into Leinster. They take Dundalk. They're outside Drogheda. They're moving south. Then Wicklow, Wexford, the Oberon, starts rising. The old English are now suddenly in an absolute bind. They have desperately tried to play politics throughout the 1600s, various parliaments. It's not really gotten them anywhere. And they have a choice. Certainly if you take County Louth, for example, if you've got a Gaelic army from Ulster marching in and Dublin, London, is not coming to your aid, well, you've to quickly decide
what you're going to do.
There's a number of meetings held, one near Bellerstown, one the Hill of Tara. The old English go for it. They pitch in. They join Irish.
They join in. And like,
yes.
Putting this up,
while professing loyalty to the King.
But explain to people at home, like, this is like, you're talking about, in terms of the population of Ireland now, you're talking about a lot of the overall population arising in revolt by this point.
We're now talking practically, we're talking like 95% is now up and running in this rebellion. Dublin at this point is being administered by two Lord Justices, William Parsons and Burleys. Parsons is the main man. They're very puritanical, very parliamentarian, as such, they don't trust the old English at all. and they basically, it's a siege. They said they're just holding Dublin and they're praying for a parliamentarian army to arrive from England. And it finally, some, very small, as opposed to 10 or 20,000 troops arriving, which would have been the normal course, had there not been this mad stalemate in a standoff in England. 1,100 troops arrive on at the very end of December in 1641, led by Sir Simon Harcourt. And now we have, he is a very highly respected officer. He's been since the age of 16 serving in Holland in the Dutch army. Harcourt would appear to have set out with some cavalry in March of 1642, and it would appear they encountered some of the insurgent cavalry en route. Bit of an exchange, wherever they pursue them, they take refuge in Carrickmines Castle.
So when you say they,
the insurgents.
Okay, so Harcourt has chased these people.
Yeah, it's
to
kind of
it
seems
Castle.
To be all very casual, very nondescript, inconsequential, just kind of casual, like accidental meeting, whatever. Now, Theobald Walsh, who is the owner of Carrick Mines, who had some soldiering experience on the continent in the what you didn't allow me to go into the 30 Years' War while fighting for the Habsburgs. He's an experienced soldier. Now, he had, previous to this, brought up a cannon from a relation of his from Bullock Harbour, Bullock Castle. But after Kilgobbin Castle is taken in a day's fighting and Dundrum Castle is just occupied, I think, you know, what I do know is for Theobald sends this cannon back to Buller. Now, if he had been planning to defend his castle, the last thing a professional soldier would do is dispose of his best piece of ordnance, i.e. his only cannon. So, the indications are Theobald didn't want to defend his castle. He had realised this was inviting disaster.
Yep.
Kilsallaghan Castle in North County Dublin had already been taken, and that was his, where his wife had come from. So he's reading the land, and then there's the Battle of Dean's Grange dimension, where again the insurgent force is defeated by the Dublin forces. I think Theobald had decided, no, this is mad. Whenever they do turn up, and they will, I'll just surrender it to them.
Yep.
But he's not at home that day. These people, unnamed, whoever they are, encounter Harcourt. Harcourt pursues them. They arrive at Carrickmines. They take, the insurgents take refuge within. Now, this is where it becomes subject to interpretation, is that it is said they made gestures. They, whatever they did, they really pissed off Harcourt.
Outside the castle now.
Yes.
They're taunting him or whatever.
They're taunting him and they're making gestures. And it's even if your listeners would like to look into it, you can see that actually some of the hand gestures, rude variety that are known to us, some of them actually have great antiquity, which came as news to me. And I would refer people to the middle digit. Look at its history. Let's say it was not unknown to the Romans. But whatever gestures and calls were made to Harcourt, he only has a small detachment of cavalry. He's already discovered when they're fighting outside Kilsallaghan, which initially they can't take because no heavy guns. And with heavy guns, you need support and infantry. Yes. He's got none of this.
Yeah.
Now, why doesn't he just say, right, in the best Arnie tradition, say, I'll be back. Why doesn't he head back to Dublin and come back?
Yeah.
No, he doesn't. He gets off his horse. And with his detachment of cavalry are staying there, I can only interpret this as like he was determined that the people who had insulted him would be, they'd be gone
Oh, that he's going to make sure no one gets away.
He's making sure they're going nowhere.
Okay.
And eventually, he has all the stuff he needs. And they attack.
So when you say, just to give people a sense here, they're attacking the castle, like, what do they have? Like, do they have cannons? Do they have...
He has to, and this is why there's a whole delay. And they've now gone into, that was a Saturday, they've now gone into Sunday. And Harcourt, as we know, is he's very religious.
I said they won't attack on a Sunday.
He doesn't like fighting on a Sunday.
Okay.
But now he has to, because he has to. So he waits. He has to wait for his heavy artillery to arrive. He has to wait for infantry to arrive. So it takes all this 24 hours. Like this, he's now. It's in military terms. This is now all ridiculous. He could have just ridden back to Dublin, organized a force, and turned up a week later. If his objective was to take the castle. My argument would be, and as I say, I can't go into all the reasons are in the book, he is more determined to get the people who have insulted him as opposed to the people who are occupying the castle, because the castle ain't going anywhere.
Yeah.
Instead, he has to wait overnight. They probably have no tents or anything with them. This is all. You do not launch an attack on a castle with a small detachment of cavalry.
Yeah.
And he knows that. He has been soldiering since the age of 16. He's now in the sleigh. He's nearly 40.
So they haul out heavy
guns. They have to wait for the heavy guns to come, and they have to be hauled by oxen or horse or whatever on
and just to let people know,
lousy roads.
Mines is about like 10, 12 miles, is it?
Yeah.
You're not doing this in an hour.
No. This is really not a way to go about siege. So okay. I think the whole thing is a bloody... Theobald Walsh had no intention of defending it. Harcourt had no intention of attacking it. And yet we're in this bloody situation.
You have this situation. They brought out the cannon. You have all these people in the castle. They've surrounded it.
Yes.
And now they're preparing to attack it.
Yes.
Right at this point, what follows next is a massacre and archaeological excavation. But we're going to stop right now. Me and Mark have empty glasses. We're going to get...
Good God, well observed, sir.
We're going to get drinks in, and we're going to pick a story up after this.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Recently, I had a minor argument with a close friend that brought up things from my past that I really needed to get off my chest. I think we've all been there. Now, I found therapy a really great way to work through these issues. For me, I really like online therapy, and BetterHelp is a really great online service that allows you to make space for therapy no matter how busy you are. BetterHelp is convenient, affordable, and gives you the support you need, but also works around your schedule. It's really easy to get up and running with a therapist on BetterHelp. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. You can do your sessions by text, phone, or video call, whichever suits you best. It's all about flexibility, working around your schedule. At the moment, BetterHelp are offering listeners to the show 10% off their first month. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Irish History today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Irish History. Okay, folks, me and Mark are back now, and we've got our drinks, and we're ready to go.
It's actually 5 pints later.
We left it just as an attack is about to begin. Mark, take it away.
Yeah, the thing about Harcourt now, because he's a general that leads from the front. Indeed, it's amazing he's still alive, because even if you go back to his early career in Holland, in 1628, during the siege of a town in Holland that's now called Den Bosch, or Hertogen Bosch, to give her his full title, and that it was recorded at the time that he was 5 times thrust and shot through his clothes, and then 1632 he got a bullet through the mouth, through his cheeks, by the palate of his mouth. Meanwhile, a crude grenade type thing has exploded, cutting him badly in the thigh. It's amazing this man is still alive, because he leads from the front. And sure enough, at Carrick Mines, the two heavy guns arrive from Dublin. Harcourt goes forward with them. They're getting them into a prime position to fire on the castle. Harcourt steps out, and a sniper from the castle hits him with a shot in the right chest. He's badly wounded. Clearly, he has to be helped from into a nearby cabin, and he's in a bad way. And they start moving him back towards Dublin.
So he's out of the picture.
Out of the picture.
Okay,
but his men, his officers. And also, as research when working for the Carrick Mines book, I discovered that amongst the officer corps is his brother-in-law, his cousin, and some people he's been soldiering with since Holland. These are friends. These are relatives.
So it becomes a highly personal...
They're not happy with this at all. Yeah. They know he's in a very bad way.
And like, just to point out to people, if he's been shot in the chest, he's gone back into Dublin, you're probably thinking that guy's not going to make it.
They're pretty much, they can see it. He's badly. He can barely talk. He's mumbling about, like, look after my wife and children and all the rest of it, and he's taken away. One of the last orders he gives is maybe go for the gate. They charge forward with axes and things. They hack down the gate. They break into the courtyard. And then there's a bit more exchange, and then they're into the main building. The castle surrenders, because it's clear now. They're within the main building. They can expect that it's just standard for the time that certainly the military defenders of it are going to be executed.
Okay.
But that's probably as far as... Obviously, this is all happening very fast. But what they don't know is that Harcourt has been mortally wounded.
Okay, so that they don't realise how personalised this whole event has become.
Yeah, they don't realise that these people are now in a seriously negative frame of mind. And it would appear that basically what happens next is that they kill everybody, men, women, children, that are in the castle, either actively defending it, possibly members of the household. We do know, because we uncovered 2 mass burials, and they were basically thrown head to toe. These are massacre pits, you know, where there's no question of formal burial here. These are just bodies dumped into a shallow hole in the ground. We know they're in a bad way, because Linda Fibiger, Dr. Linda Fibiger, who was our specialist who analysed the bones. Most of them had been hit by sword cuts or bludgeoned from behind. So they're being chased around the place. Basically, people are running willy-nilly all around the building, around the yards, with people pursuing them and cutting them down from behind. And the fact that we discovered a number of coins, shillings, sixpences and that, in one of these graves, is that it shows that these people were, because it was a fairly normal thing at the time that corpses would be stripped and searched any goods, jewellery or whatever. It's clearly that these people weren't, and I think as Linda put it, like that the clothes were probably in a very bloody state and all the rest of this, so just grab them, threw them into burial pits, and then they blow up parts of the castle and the fortified dwelling, and that's the starting point as to why there wasn't much left for us to see when we arrived there to excavate it. And then over the subsequent years, the remainder of it is demolished, stones probably
used for different houses.
And so it all ends very suddenly, a site that has been going since the 12th century or whatever, because we discovered evidence during the excavations for a nearly horizontal mill dating to, say, the early 1100s, like that's pre-Norman arrival or anything.
So it's continuous life there.
Continuous life has been there for centuries and centuries, and on that Sunday morning in March 1642, it all ends up in this unbelievably bloody melee, basically.
And life at the castle, as it was known,
ends.
Just maybe to bring then the story, there's one thing I want to talk with Mark just before we finish, and to bring the story full circle. We started out at the start of today's show talking about a Norman invasion, how Carrick Mines had become this frontier outpost, I suppose. A very important place in terms of chronicling Irish life between 1200 and 1600, in terms of understanding a lot of the things that Mark has talked about. That was recovered then in the 2000s in an archaeological excavation. There was a huge amount of information that was retrieved from the site, but the actual landscape, as Mark has touched on there, actually was very important in terms of understanding what we've talked about. Sadly today, you can't actually access this. Huge amounts of that site has been completely destroyed because this motorway runs through it. Now, Mark has published a book, and I guess that's now become, I guess, the surviving testimony to all this. But just a couple of days before we've recorded this interview, Mark published an article in the Irish Times where he talked not just about, like, it was far greater than what we're talking about today, just what's going on in Ireland today in terms of the loss of archaeological sites, what this means for this country going forward. Just want to say a few words on that.
Yeah, I think it's there's a dreadful expression that has been coined by officialdom, and it's and I love the use of the word, the misuse of the word, preservation. Great start. Preservation by record. What this means, in effect, is our alternative title for this is destruction by documentation. So basically, once you excavate a site, it's whacked. It's gone. It's obliterated. As opposed to in previous years, where if a site of importance was discovered, and I'm not talking about, look, there's thousands and thousands of archaeological sites, and with respect, once they're properly excavated, that's it. That's fine. A report is all you need. But there has to be a balance. How can there be thousands upon thousands of sites excavated, and yet, where are the new monuments? And after all, we want monuments for people to visit. And heaven knows the Irish state trades off it furiously with their Ireland's ancient East and all the rest of it. But we need new tourist attractions. We need new standing monuments.
But I think to highlight this, as someone who worked on that excavation, and I've worked on a fair few excavations, that one in particular stood out because there was a story that you could tell, a very crucial part, like what we've talked about today, in that physical landscape. It's not just that it in itself was Like it reflected much more than just like history kind of concentrated.
Oh yeah,
well,
people,
on that landscape.
People should remember, like, and I mean, there's often like when people hear the expression national monument, there's actually five criteria by which a site qualifies as a national museum. And define alphabetical order, historical comes first. So an archaeological purist would be saying, oh, but there's no Trim Castle there. It's not Trim Castle, it's not Carrickfergus Castle and all the rest of it. But, you know, I mean, if you're to say, why don't we demolish that sort of nondescript little cottage in Connemara, and you go, oh, wait a minute, that was Pádraic Pearse's cottage.
Or
that little council house outside Slane. Oh, wait a minute, that's Francis Ledridge's. Or down in Dungastown, actually it's only in a run-of-the-mill farmhouse. Oh wait, that's the John Fitzgerald Kennedy, that's the Kennedy homestead.
And it's the historical connection that makes these places.
It doesn't have to be Trim Castle to be an important castle site.
I think as well, something that I would talk a bit about on the podcast is that, like, the history of ordinary people is not recorded in places like Trim Castle. It's recorded in, like, say for example, maybe a classic example is tenements in Dublin.
Yeah, well, yes.
Like, a lot of those places might not be worth, but there's a story and a history.
It's the story and the associations.
Yes,
it's
exactly,
not brick and mortar.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if
humans
if,
have infused something else into us, yeah.
Exactly. It's at a, as I have hoped to that I've got across today, is that this is why we got so wrapped up in it. It's because it suddenly started, the more we got to know all these people, and people is the key word, men and women and children, and started learning their names, is that that's why we became so attached to it. That's why we got involved in three Supreme Court cases, and with the invaluable Dominic Dunn, Gordon Lucas, you know, Professor Sean Duffy, Dr. David Edwards, is this Eamon P. Kelly National Museum. This why we all became is because the more we got to know about, the more passionate we became about. And God forbid that we should ever reach the point as academics that we're just, that it's all just bricks and mortar, preservation by record. As Waddell, Emeritus Professor of Galway, said, you could argue that the dodo duck has been preserved by taxidermy.
And with that comment from Mark, I think it's a fitting point to end today's show. That's the podcast finished for 2019. I'd like to thank you all for tuning in throughout the year. All I want to say now is thanks to Mark for his time for this interview today. I'll be back in 2020 when we're going to pick up the series Partisans. I hope you all have a lovely Christmas and a happy new year. I'll be talking to you in 2020. Until then, Sloan.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.